What's up, everybody? It's time. Welcome to ACG&D episode 4. Episode 4. I want to say thanks to everybody who has joined in, shared this. It's been absolutely incredible. We shot up the ranks in iTunes as well as Spotify. If you get a chance, make sure to go out there. Leave a review if you like these, if you like the video game review, the video game podcasts, all of this stuff. Please leave a like, subscribe, follow, that kind of stuff. Subscribing doesn't even cost you anything. I'm just there. It's called subscribe, I believe, on iTunes. But I would love for you to do so. Also, we're on Podbean. We're on Google Cast. We're on TuneIn. We're on pretty much everything. So you can always follow and listen to us there. This is the D&D podcast where I talk about role playing. I talk about pen and paper. I talk about my other loves. But we're also going to talk about video games. This will end up overlapping at various times. For example, Cyberpunk, which was originally a role playing game and has now become a pen and paper game. As always, this podcast is sponsored by absolutely friggin' nobody. Well, technically, it's sponsored by you, the people listening, as well as the people on Patreon. So thanks to you guys, but no commercial sponsors. What's my goal and why do I do these kind of things? Well, other than just absolutely loving it, I want to know what you guys need for me to get into role-playing. This is a time when the world is completely different than it was last year at this time. It really is. It's completely changed. And a lot of people wanting to get into D&D, they want to get into role-playing, they want to know the ins and outs, and it's becoming a little bit less of a nerd kind of thing, and you're having, you know, channels on Twitch, and you're having channels on YouTube streaming this, which will do the same. But it's for me to basically answer your questions and give you some setups for how to get into this more easily. 25 plus years of being a GM with games that have lasted for over 2 decades. I have a little bit of experience at it. It's not perfect experience, and it's not always right. It's just my impressions, but I always try to be open and flexible when it comes to discussion about these kind of things. My goal is to get you into the games. My goal is to make you at least understand what's going on. And hell, if my goal doesn't even do that and makes you understand now how an IP can go from a role-playing game to a video game or back and forth, you know what? That's a step in the right direction as well. In the past couple episodes, we've made a character, Joshua Meadows, and I showed you guys how to use idioms to create a character that helps newcomers really identify a little bit easier instead of just a set of numbers, but using idioms that also equal numbers so that a person has a set of sentences or a set of traits that they can really identify with. So instead of strength, they have the score that you would normally have in strength, but they also have the idiom once in a blue moon, and that allows them to roleplay and figure out exactly what that means, you know, and does that help them roleplay. I have also created links to all this. You can see the character sheet at https://rebrand.ly/ACGD&D1. That will be a fillable werewolf character sheet. You can go there. It's going to show you that it is called PDF filler, and that is a fillable character sheet. So you can see the stats that I'm talking about when I talk. Sorry about that. My Alexa was reminding me to remind me that I was supposed to do a podcast right now. So anyway, make sure to check out that character sheet. That'll show you what character sheet I am talking about when I talk about these various different things. The next is you can now see the character that we're building. And this is Joshua Meadows. You'll be able to actually see this on OneNote. Again, it is https://rebrand.ly/ACGD&D sample. So you'll have both of those. And if you want to open them, you can. That'll give you my idea of the character. I loaded up a little picture that I found and sort of adjusted and made for this character, as well as a very brusque, very basic background, which I don't think I'll keep other than the wife dying, which is something we talked about before. Those idioms helped me create this character, something that is already sort of being built instead of getting to the end. So a lot of times in Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing, a person will say, I want to be this or that, and they'll roll some stats. Or they'll roll some stats and say, I want to be this or that. But the background usually comes at the end. Or for many DMs, it comes at the end. What I'm trying to do is sort of create what you would term as a mid-ground, okay? And that's what the idioms do. They create a mid-ground that allows for you to really create a junction between the numbers and your background and make them fit together a little bit easier. It's not always saying, hey man, I'm big and strong, so I'm gonna be an ex-weightlifter. But instead, you may have something where card up your sleeve is the idiom, which is worth a 5 on strength. And that could mean something else. Like maybe you look woefully inadequate for what you actually are. Maybe you've got that rangy kind of corded muscle that we see in a lot of military special forces. Also, let's do the hashtag right now. Hashtag ACGDND. I would love for you guys to hashtag this out and start the discussion. If you have any questions, if you liked it, please just, you know, say so. It would be great because we have multiple thousands of people listening to this. But the feedback's difficult because a lot of places where the podcast posts, people can't be able to sort of jump in and leave a comment. There's only a couple places where people can. So let's discuss a couple things. We're going to, just for a moment, sort of put away Joshua Meadows. So you can leave that character up if you've opened them. Again, those links will be in the description as well as you can hear them earlier. What I want to do is answer some of the questions that have come up in the last couple days, as well as a couple that I missed that were on Patreon that I had in the past when it was coming to D&D. So I'm going to answer some of these. So I would listen. You know, I know a lot of people are like, I don't like a question and answer type of situation. These will be short, but I do know that a lot of people have sort of the same generic questions. And so I want to get those out and I want to get them answered. First up, a patron says, this is Biv. What's up, Biv? I know Biv is a big D&D role-playing fan. She says, what systems and settings have you enjoyed the most and why? Until this year, my experience with pen and paper was mostly entirely D&D 5th edition. And then when I finally started taking a look at other stuff, I felt like I had seen the light. So I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts. Well, that's a good question because I'm going to do the top five role-playing systems that I like when it comes to just immersion and the feeling of fun in a bit, so I'll answer that in a second. But I will say some of my favorite, which a little bit of retread. World of Darkness, D10 dice pools are some of my favorites. Specific games that use cards. Suited is a very small game. I think it's only like 10-15 pages. It's just a rules system, but it shows how to use normal playing cards when you don't have dice. And it's actually a pretty fantastic rule system. It mimics my own that we've been using now for 20 years. We use dice in other games, but for our main preliminary game, we actually use playing cards and some various rules around that. But you can use anything. That one I really do like. I think that they're is a reason why people like D&D 5th edition, because for a lot of people, and remembering that D&D really has sort of shifted over to being more video game-like, it's easy sometimes for people to have this ironclad rule. And you'll see this, unfortunately, in the discussion. I would say the discussion I've found, at least, around D&D to be really harsh. There's a lot of discussion where somebody's like, actually, you got that wrong and you got this wrong. And even the big wigs who cover D&D all the time, you have a lot of toxicity around the discussion. And to me, role-playing, homebrew rules, by the way, or hacking, depending on whatever term you want to use. There's a lot of changing of terms, by the way, in Dungeons & Dragons. And that's one of the things I'm here to tell you about is most of the time, these changes in terms are just people wanting to specify that their genre feels special to them when it really isn't anything new. So you hear somebody say, oh, we hacked this game or we did this. Really, that would just be an entire homebrew built on the basics of another set. That would be your hack. And then when it comes to homebrew rules or rules adjustments for 5th edition or something like that, that just means there's some different rules that somebody's taken in. And there's about 50 other terms for that. But don't get too confused on those. So I'll discuss more of that in a moment, Biv. Tim says, what are your opinions on evil aligned PCs? Have you had any interesting instances where those characters' actions either made for interesting and fun experiences or went really poorly? I make sure that if somebody's using nature and alignment or nature and demeanor, I'm sorry, or alignment, if somebody's using any kind of system, there is a heady description around what sort of works in that world and what your repercussions may be. I've been DMing for a long time. So even in the opening sections of where I might be describing something, I will drop in little things like, for example, if it's a cyberpunk style of world, I may drop in the feeling of anarchy or the feeling of an overarching structural presence when it comes to a police force. Little hints that give it away. Almost nothing I do when I DM is black and white. I would say, in fact, it's pretty much almost never me saying it's a number. So if somebody said, like, you know, how heavy is the police presence? I wouldn't say, oh, it's pretty heavy. I would state the things that a character sees through their view and through their senses, through their smells, right? What you may see. Do you notice, let's say when you're in a food court in a Blade Runner style game, do you notice that all of the food court sections and markets are perfectly aligned in long drawn out sort of metric types of systems? They're built like Legos. Well, that might indicate an overarching kind of citation system that requires people who want to build a food court to be, structured and be more ordered, which also would mean maybe there's something going on with the police presence there where they want to make sure that, for example, every single market has a small gap between them so a thief can't get behind a set of market stalls and run off and the police can't get to them. Yeah, I think of these things. And it's funny because a lot of people who build stuff, those kind of things, especially as you gain experience and those situations occur to you, you start building up this almost rule book of things you need to take care of. And only experience can take care of that. But experience doesn't mean you have to, I say experience, but knowledge of them. It doesn't mean you have to experience it. Me telling you can be the experience where it's like, hey, you may want to think of these things. So I would say with evil aligned PCs, no, we haven't had any real issues because those people know what can happen, including internal group discord and also a discussion with anybody who has any kind of character that is dramatically different than anybody else. We want to put them together for a reason, right? There needs to be a reason. And if there isn't one, well, that's not really a role-playing session that that may turn out well. And you may want to look at that as a one-off, which I'll talk about later. What are one-offs? One-offs are one-pages or one-shots. Again, everybody wants to call them something different because they want to feel special. But basically what one-offs are is they're a one-night or a very small extra adventure. They don't have to be in your game world at all. But what we do is if somebody wants to do something different, we will have a one-off. For example, we have about a 5-year game in a post-apocalyptic magic-ridden world. And we had been playing out, not outlaws, but adventurers for many years. One time, one of the guys couldn't be there. Now, I am a firm believer that if one party member can't be there, I don't do anything where it's like, oh, they're just gone, and or I play them. We usually will do a one-off. It just doesn't make any sense. I want that person to be involved, and unless they're leaving for full time, I just don't do that. But what I do is one-offs. And so what we did was we played police that were after our characters. And we ended up killing one of the characters. He told me, he's like, listen, all of them stay. He wasn't there. He's like, listen, if this happens, because I told him what was going on. He's like, if this happens, and if, you know, you guys corner me, I'd like you to use my rules, whatever. But if I die, that's okay. I'll come as somebody else. Like, I love that character, but that would really work. And so what was great was it was about 2 weeks after the last game. So we basically said a week or two had passed between our heroes doing stuff and our characters who were hunting them down. And admittedly, our characters had done something terrible on accident. It was a complete on accident, but basically due to a ton of really bad situations, half of a town had burned down. And people had basically realized it was us who caused it, which in the end, it technically was. And so these guys, it finally created this posse, and that posse was us. And what was great was we don't play every day. We play about every 2 weeks. So what happened was, you know, there's a little bit of muddlement, a little bit of befuddlement about what happened 5 games ago. And you have to look at your notes, right? Well, what we did was we said, hey, nobody's looking at your notes. These are characters who their job is to hunt down people. So what they know is what you've done and what you can remember, which would make sense. You're a private investigator. You're the Al Pacino versus De Niro in Heat, right? You know these guys in and out. And so we hunted this character. And Denny, I apologize, your guy died. But we hunted this guy, right? We hunted him. And we knew a lot about him. We didn't know exactly what, remember every single item that we had or anything like that because we weren't playing those characters. And we decided, let's not look at him. We hunted this guy down and we got one of them, which was Denny. And it was one of the most enjoyable games we've ever seen. So to me, that's sort of tangentially connected to your question, but it does give you an idea of how all of this can sort of come together and how you can do a one shot if somebody wants to do an evil aligned character and how you can go about that. Because one of the big problems in all games is how much you know. And I'm a firm believer in using reality. And what we didn't know was things that had happened 4 or 5 games prior because we just didn't remember or didn't have perfect notes. So playing characters who knew a lot about us because they were hunting us and had studied us worked perfect. Joshua's asking a video game question. He may, oh, he may have misread this, but he real quick, he just says, is there anything more depressing than seeing a bunch of cinematic trailers at a big reveal event like the Video Game Awards? Yes, there are many things, but I get your drift. And then on Twitter, real quick, Lusano says, what's your strategy for dealing with that one pesky newcomer who wants to fuck with the DM and stray away from the world bounds? Like I stated prior, and I'm sure you guys remember, I vet people very heavily, and so it just really does not happen unless it fits the character, and then I'm prepared for it. Stein K says, don't know if it fits the theme, but maybe discuss what an RPG is and what it is not. Okay, that's very good. Lusano also asks, what's your fondest memory of a crazy idea as a DM or player that played a pivotal role of the campaign? Well, I can tell you this. I do all my D&D off the cuff, and I set up a good idea in my head for a game. And one of my players, Roger, he just decided he didn't want to play that game. He just straight up was like, dude, I don't want to do this. Now, he didn't tell me that, right? I didn't require him to tell me that. We get there, we start talking, and this guy's trying to not give us a job because we don't do the go to the bar and get a job. It's never like that. But we ended up talking to this character who was giving us information at what had happened inside of this kingdom. And Roger was just like, I ain't having it. I don't like this guy. We know this guy isn't necessarily good anyway. And he killed him. And he did it in a way where he's like, I get up to him. Basically, Roger played it out as a social event. He's like, when he was talking, he's like, I walk up to him. I get close in his face. And I'm like, listen, man. You know, so it made it sound all realistic, right? He's like, listen, man. And then as he was talking, he's like, I grab my knife and stab him. And I'm like, what? Wait, you mean you say that? And he's like, no, I do it. And it worked out incredibly well. It shocked everybody, and it's twisted the story on its side to where we had this information about something that was going on in the kingdom, but we knew he was sort of a bad guy, but we also now were on the outs. And for me, that's what lights my fire. The biggest surprises in the world light my fire. I got to tell you, huge surprises. We've had massive ones. We've had ones where entire planets have died in events. We've had smaller ones where a character has died, a child has died or something. You know, it really does depend. But when something like that surprises me, it's the best. And that was one of those moments where we still talk about it. We're like, do you remember that time when like nobody was expecting? He just didn't want to play that. He was like, it's not really interesting to me. And instead, the entire game became interesting to everybody because it flipped everything. I do want to add two caveats. I'm adding this late. I do want to add two caveats to that. One, we're an experienced group, and I do know how to handle those things. Number two, this is not something I would suggest that random people do. It's not something that most game masters don't do completely off-the-cuff storytelling like I do, where I set up a skeleton and pretty much that's it. So I want to make sure that's very clear. Please don't do that to your DM, or maybe talk to your DM and see if those kind of weird oddities are acceptable, if true reign and true free actions are possible. So I just want to make sure that that's out there. Just got a couple more. Brandon says, what's your favorite kind of world to have your friends in, like a cyberpunk future? Ours is definitely post-apocalyptic with magic involved. We've really had it Book of Eli, but add magic, that kind of stuff. We've had an incredible time playing that, and I mean, I've really never heard any explanations or anybody bitching about it. We built a world around it. Those are some of my favorites. Anything with a little bit of magic is always my favorite, even if that magic is hidden in tech. So, for example, I love Fading Suns because it's got, you know, ancient technologies that appear a little bit like magic. And then, of course, you have Warhammer 40,000 with its chaos. And, of course, spiritually, I guess you would say that was magic. They call it, you know, psychosis or whatever it is, not psychosis, psionics, you get my drift. Psychosis is pretty actually apt for a Warhammer 40,000 game. Chris Dietz says, is there a better class combo than the Barbarian? Yes, many. Chuck E says, have you ever played Cyberpunk 2020? Seems like a fitting year to play. No. Santiago says, does discussion of Divinity Original Sin 2 count? I think that's a game that deserves a lot of love. It doesn't. I'm sorry. And then, he says, I mean Divinity as some D&D influence, at least I think so. You can make custom campaigns. Yeah, so we'll talk about moving digital and back and forth between digital and analog today for sure. Here we go. We're about 20 minutes in. I apologize, but I wanted to get those questions out because you'd be surprised at how often somebody's question overlaps or an answer overlaps. The first thing I want to talk about is my top five RPGs. These are not the top five best rules. They're not the top five best worlds. What they are is just the top five best RPGs to me as a whole. That means their interactions, their mechanics, their influences on me, their impressions upon me are the highest. And it does not in any way, shape, or form dismiss thousands of others. It's the top five I can think of right now. And I bet you, if you grabbed me and at a different time and you asked, I wouldn't have five completely different ones because some of these are always going to be top dog. But some would change. That's absolutely sure. So I would say this, the top five, first of all, Warhammer 2nd Edition. That's right. Warhammer Roleplay Fantasy 2nd Edition, by the way. It is a percentile rolling system, 1d100 and 1d10 for attributes that can be turned to 1d100 by basically just adding a zero to the end of any stat if you need to in some way cross-reference. The reason why this works so well, first of all, the book art is incredible, and I am a whore for art. So when I see art, I can make up an entire world on some art. If I see, I mean, it just doesn't matter, especially if I'm, you know, really good and on that day and somebody shows me amazing art, boom, I'm there. And so that art was incredible. But 1D100 I love because I love the giant difference in stats. And let me describe that. If two people are rolling weapon skill on a 1D100, there is 99 differences they can have, right? And technically, if you can go above 100, there's a couple more. So, but you have... you have 99 differences in the scaling that you can do, and that can be really disconcerting to a new DM, but I got into second edition after a great deal of time, and I was already chafing against the smaller rule systems, the D10s, D20s. Now, I know a lot of people be like, well, that offers enough, you know, the difference between a 15 and a 10 is big enough for me. I get that, right? I get that. But when you've been playing for a long time, and depending on your rule systems, depending on your characters and their abilities, sometimes you get something that I absolutely dislike, which is totally balanced. And I don't mean unbalanced is the opposite and unfair is my desire. I mean where sometimes you're like, this guy's swordsmanship. For example, a lot of games will be like, oh man, at some point you can just buy a skill that allows you to use your dexterity instead of your strength, and somebody else is using their strength. And when they get that, when those two people get those overlapping skills, despite them being slightly different perks, suddenly they're identical. I hope you get my drift. So suddenly, because of somebody's perk somebody bought, they're now pretty much identical in their basic score for, let's say, attacking with a sword. And you're like, I don't know if that works perfectly for me in a smaller group of numbers, 1d20 for difficulty, let's say. But 100 does allow for a little bit more variation when you do have those skill overlaps. And I just love it. I don't know anything else to say. 1d100 feels good to me with 55 versus, you know, a 60. What does that mean? What's the small inflections between a master, right? A master at something and somebody who's not only a master, but just slightly better. And with those as a storyteller, I can get in deep and describe the slight twist of a wrist during a parry that is consistently putting the master slightly off balance, you know, versus the person who is just a master, but a little bit better or has practiced this very particular move. And again, that's nerdy. And it's not something I would suggest for everybody else. Next up, World of Darkness. I've talked about this. World of Darkness encompassed a shit ton of basic rule systems. World systems. Let me give you an example. Vampire the Masquerade is based on World of Darkness. So if you don't know pen and paper and you do know Vampire the Masquerade, you're good to go. Vampire Redemption was another one based in that world. Werewolf is coming out this year or maybe early next year. That's also based in this world. There's a mage game. So what happened was each one of these groups of books really covered the main type of character. Your werewolf for Werewolf the Apocalypse, Vampire the Masquerade, your vampires. What was it? Magic? Was it Mage the Reckoning? Or was that Wraith the Reckoning? There was something the Reckoning. And then there was Mage. There was Mummy. There were side books that came out. And what they did was they covered, unlike the Star Wars Fantasy Flight stuff I talked before, they covered not only the main entire mythology, racial systems, species systems, if you will, magic systems, but they also explained how differing groups in the same exact core cannot necessarily agree, even if they use the same words. Let me give you an example. In Werewolf, you have the Trinity of Gods, Weaver, the Wild, and the Worm. The Weaver weaves reality. The Wild is there to basically inject chaos into the Weaver's web. And the Worm Its job, when it started, when the universe started, was to simply destroy and create equal opportunities for those two to basically exist. So the Weaver didn't get too strong and create systems and science that was so overbiting and so overarching that the world couldn't move forward with the chaos of even DNA. And then the Wild would interject itself, and the Worm's job was to do that. Now, what was awesome about each one of these worlds is they all describe that slightly different. In Werewolf, the Worm went insane. It looked at the Weaver's web and at some point realized its job, right, was too difficult. The only way for the Worm to not let the Weaver or the Wild win was to destroy all the time. And so in Werewolf the Apocalypse, the Worm is the bad guys, and the vampires are basically created by the Worm, right? They've got a slightly more evil subset, and when you look at them, you almost see something different if you're playing that rule set than if you're playing Vampyr, the Masquerade. They handle those things slightly different, and then if you handle Mummy, they tangentially sort of cover those, because those were created not using the Weaver, the Wild, and the Worm. They were created via alchemy magics, but they know who the Weaver, the Wild, and the Worm are, right? Each world's this way. Then mages are the Weaver. So mages are able to adjust reality. So for example, in their world, they can create a fireball, but they explain it away using technology. And if they don't do a good job, chaos can reign. So their job is really a reflection of the Weaver in many ways. Now, you can have magic users that are chaos. We'll get to that in some other description. But if you understand, these three source books were all written from the same overarching terminologies and details, but they adjusted it for the world and viewpoint of the characters. The werewolves were fighting against the destruction of nature. They were nature's, they were Gaia's, the Earth's destroyers against the Worm. And then the Vampyr were something completely different. And they also had overlapping ones. The vampire, you have the Bruja, which are more of the bestial ones. You've even got the Nosferatu. And then in the mage, they have their groups of chaos magicians or chaos magi as well. So it was incredible. It was thematically incredible to see this and to read them and be like, whoa, these guys believe the same thing, but something slightly different. And it was awesome. Next up, Mythic. People might not know what this is. Mythic is a solo D&D game. So in solo D&D, you might be like, how the fuck does that work? But in solo D&D, basically what happens is, you as the gamer make up a world like your storytelling. So if I were to play solo D&D, I would describe it as if you guys were there. In fact, I would tell people that if I'm doing solo D&D, it really is just playing, but the listeners are delayed, and that would be you guys on the podcast. And so what happens is you would describe your world and you would describe what your characters are doing. You make your character, all that. And then Mythic's rule system is a series of general devices and generators that allow for you to interject surprising results into a solo game. So a solo game would normally be like, well, I know everything that's happening, right? Well, first of all, random generators help that. But with Mythic, if you want to do something, you ask the rule system a question, just as if you would ask a D&D DM a question. So for example, I'm in the bottom of some kind of base. I'm underground. It's a four-way intersection in the sewers. And I come down there, I've got my stats, just like any game, you can use Mythic and stats, you can do all this kind of stuff, and I look around. In a normal Dungeons and Dragons game, you might state what skill you're using. It depends on what game you're playing. You might just state, I look around, whatever. In Mythic, it's the same way. You would state, you know, I look around, I want to see, is there anything out of the ordinary? What Mythic does is it has a rule system that isn't just success and failure. It's yes, yes but, yes and, even, and then no and, no but, and no. So if you get a no, do I notice anything out of the ordinary? No. To my character, then I would understand, well, to my character, no. That doesn't mean no to everybody. That means to my character, who's got a specific background and all that stuff, no. But what if I get no but as an answer? Well, if I get no but, that means that no, there's nothing unusual here, but you add something to it. And the but is usually a negative connotation. This is just going to sound funny when anybody's listening to this. But the but, it's a negative connotation in some way. So it would make something worse. Like, do I succeed? And it would be a negative connotation on a positive and then a positive connotation on a negative. So change it to yes, but. That is a positive result, but then a negative addition. So you'd say, you know, I smash this guy in the face. Do I hit him? Yes, but, and then you say you break your hand, right? No, and would say you hit him and he falls back completely stunned. No would be you miss. I said no, and I meant yes, and. So that's how Mythic works. And there's tons of these solo D&D systems. And really, if you look at it, it's not really doing a lot that we haven't seen in other games, which is a success, right? A great success or a massive success. What Mythic does is it turns it into a word kind of thing, which you guys know with idioms I'm a fan of. And I think it works really well. And you can take Mythic and easily make a group D&D game with it. It's actually a fantastic rule system. Again, it's only one of tons of Oracle systems out there. So don't be surprised if somebody else offers a different one. My next up would probably also be on my worst, but it's also my best, and that's Warhammer 40,000. So listen, Warhammer 40,000's lore is incredible. I don't like the rules very much, even though originally they were more based on the second edition Warhammer roleplay that I talked about, the D100 percentile. A lot of tabletop has injected itself into this game. Warhammer 40,000 is so over the top. It makes over the top look incredibly boring. Like every other D&D game that says it's action-packed is the missionary sex of D&D game compared to the lore, the crazy absolute shit that goes on in Warhammer 40,000. It's fucking nuts. And I love that about it. I really do love it. And I think sometimes I just like reading the rule books because I'm just like, what the hell? Just so many crazy characters, so many weird things, so many different groups, chaos and demons and all this kind of stuff. Warhammer 40,000 nails it in that worldview. A worldview that I would say is particularly crushing to a lot of people when they start reading it because there's almost too much, right? And the rules, I think, aren't necessarily the greatest. But when it comes to just an RPG and the immersion and the what the hell factor, it's got to be on there. And I would say last, and this is egotistical, but last, I would say that the one that we've made for our, you know, decade-long game, it's more than a decade now, I'm assuming, which uses cards. I find that dice are great, but let's say you're trying to get past a bouncer in a game, and the DM says roll intimidation or whatever, and you roll, and you know that you failed, right? You know that you failed. Now, you can have the DM roll for you if you want. That sort of takes some of the power away. What we do with cards is they're 1D system, so you take out face cards, that kind of stuff. The card is still drawn by the player but shown to the DM. And so that allows for the DM to have some really cool subterfuge. So, for example, in most D&D games, a person would say, I want to roll intimidation, and somebody, you fail, he says this and that, or you succeed, and he says this and that, or you see your number, and you know that's a fail, or you know that's a success. Overall, you know that the chances, we'll say, are higher. With a card game, they flash the card to the DM, the DM knows the score, and no one else does. Now, there are some rules we have where other people see the score and you don't. There's rules, there's particular situations where you would see your score as well. But for the most part, when it comes to those kind of especially social interactions, you don't know. And here's why. This is not something that can't be done in a dice-based system. It's just something that I feel works a little bit more elegantly with the cards. Somebody flashes the card. In a normal game, it's a pass and failure, or you can sort of pretend like you passed and the person will be like, oh, come on in. And you sort of get the idea that was a really low score. I don't think I succeeded. This is a trap, right? That can happen. It depends on the DM. With cards, you never know. And so what that allows for is traps and social interactions that are far more varied that still allow for the gamer to draw the card, have the card in their hand, have interactivity with the other players, and do those kind of things, but at the same time allows for the DM or GM or storyteller to modify things and make it so that you can second guess yourself. And that's one of the things that goes away with a lot of games, especially lately, where there's a safety net. There's more of a safety net when it comes to knowing exactly what's going to happen. And I think that that's okay, especially if like you're doing something on Twitch where it's more of a presentation kind of thing, where it's really not like a lot of D&D games that I've ever seen or would really want to play unless I was streaming. But when it comes to my own internal games and stuff with friends, the idea of somebody flashing a card and getting a one, let's say, there's a stunning failure. And I'm like, you know, he appears scared and says, you know, come on in, I'm really sorry. And now the players are like, ha ha, we got him, right? And then they get in, boom, trap, they get kicked out, or they get in and he's already alerted the bad guys that they're on their way, whatever. It makes you second guess, and it makes the player go an extra step to add narratively why they might want to succeed. You get my drift? It allows for them, there's that risk that's actually there. And it's not just saying, I'm going to use this special skill to get a plus two. To me, that's a board game. To me, that's a video game. And the narrative questioning that can happen with card games really does help. For example, even a gunshot. You shoot somebody in the dark. If you hear them screaming, most of the time in most dice games, you know they're screaming because you got a critical hit. Here, depending on how you want to do it, you could say, hey, in the dark, you can't see, so I see your card, you don't. Normally you might see the card, right? That kind of stuff. And suddenly they don't see the card, but the guy's screaming. That's because I've had the NPC pretend he's hurt and it's a trap. You have all kinds of weird things you can do that help you. And it also doesn't require cheating, which I think that I don't cheat in a D&D game. If something fails, it fails. If something succeeds, it succeeds. But I know a lot of people who do to keep a story going. And with the card-based games, it doesn't happen. You just never have to. You can do all kinds of crazy stuff and it works really well. So that would be my five. And I would love to know your five. Next up, we're going to talk about my one worst. Guys, the worst RPG I've ever played when it comes to rules, and I mentioned this before, is Rifts. It's terrible. It's terrible. Now, Savage Worlds took it and made their own, but they actually removed the art from what I can tell, at least the front page. I bought the PDF from RPG Drive-Thru and I haven't looked at it. But the front looks like a terrible art. And the original Rifts was the source for me for magic. It was amazing. The source books in Rifts are the best source books. They're right up there with Warhammer 40,000. But the rule system is utter shit. It's terrible. It's beyond crunchy. It's flat out fucking broken. And they've tried to fix it multiple times and it's just never been that good. So Savage World comes in, and you may like Savage Worlds more than me. I don't love it, but it's a better rule system by far. And it comes in and fixes some of that. But unfortunately, the juice, as I said at the very start of this podcast, I'm an art whore. And the juice is the art and seeing these worlds as well. And I would have rather had them just basically use the same art and adjust the rules, which it doesn't look like that's happened. I could be wrong. Again, I'd like to know what your most hated ones are, most favorite. ACGDND is the hashtag. Please do so. Please use it whenever you respond to this so I can just understand where somebody is in these podcasts and if they're working out, if there's something I should continue. I really need to sort of know. The numbers speak in one way, but I never quite know exactly if people are getting something they want out of it. Also, I know at times it can sound like I have an inherent irritability towards a lot of really ironclad rule systems. Well, I do. Okay, let's just say I do. But I don't have it towards anyone, any people. There's particular things when it comes to role-playing that work more or better for me at different times. And it doesn't mean I haven't had a great game and a really ironclad rule system, and I haven't had a terrible game and one that's more freeform. It's just that for me, a lot of times when people get into role playing, it should be about whatever they enjoy. And I enjoy a particular type of gaming. But there sets in this rule mongering that occurs. And I find that to be generally sort of opposite of the way I want to go with pen and paper role playing, because to me, it's a little bit more enjoyable to understand that there's a flexibility there that can never be replicated in a title. I personally feel that a lot of people who play open world titles inherently at some point in their lives probably would really enjoy D&D, because those open world titles and the chaos and just the emergent storytelling, that's Dungeons and Dragons, that's role playing, that's World of Darkness, that's all of these games, from Fate to Icons, it just doesn't matter. Myth, all of these kind of games, that's what pen and paper can offer. And so at times when I start to see somebody say, well, you did this skill wrong, or you guys do this skill and a percentage of 0.0002% higher, at some point I'm just like, listen, guys, I mean, is at this time in life, I'm not 100% sure that's something we need to be arguing about. And it just sort of infuriates me because I feel that it's a gatekeeping kind of thing. And normally gatekeeping, I definitely have a thing for gatekeeping, like toxicity. So there you go. So I guess I'm gatekeeping that. But normally I don't like gatekeeping at all. I feel that it's a little bit weird and a little bit uncomfortable. Unless, you know, video game reviews and video game stuff, there's some gatekeeping when it comes to, you know, just people being stupid. But for the most part, everybody should be able to join in on these things. And trying to make somebody feel ostracized because they do something's really weird. When I'm looking at different games, this is just sort of a tangent. I'll finish up with this. And then the next podcast will definitely do skills and idioms and go into some more details on stuff. But I want to talk about this playing against type. So this comes up. It's come up 3 times in questions, I think. Oh, what if we have an evil character? Stuff like that. This is a slightly different skew on that. But this is something I've told people is amazing. One of the problems that I can run into with a lot of different games is that you have this desire to minimax everything. And I know minimax now is probably considered a bad term. Like, oh, we're not minimaxing. We're just being efficient or whatever. Now, I get that. But at some point, there is a minimaxing that occurs, just like occurs in video games. I don't know if you guys play a lot of video games, if you're listening to this, but I can't tell you the number of times I've played WoW, showed up, and somebody's like, dude, that's the wrong armor, right? You need this armor that's plus 0.001% more against fire. And I get it because they want to win a raid or something, right? But I'm all, dude, it looks like shit. Now, what's cool is Transmogrify has occurred in video games. Transmogrify basically meaning if you like the look of armor, you can take the statistics of, you know, more upgradable armor and move those over. But I think that's still sort of showing that there can be an issue where the statistics for particular things create a winner, I guess. And to me, the winner is more on the roleplay side, the ROLE side. And so when I'm looking at situations like this, I see a lot of mini-maxing where it's like, oh, I've got, you know, this perk and I'm going to use this perk. And it's not necessarily at the expense ever of the player and their abilities because they want to be the highest. And I've seen a lot of DMs who sort of pride themselves on killing players. And I want to discuss all this in one thing. I'm not a DM who prides myself on killing players. I'm also not a DM who prides myself on throwing thousands of battles together so that players can battle 1,000 different bad guys. You can have that if you want. I'm also not a player that is like, we're all going to be thespians and no one's going to battle at all. Or we're going to have a word of wits battle. No. Everybody's got a mixture and mine's definitely a mix. But I also don't balance the battles, for instance. I know that challenge rating is a huge deal now where they're like, oh, well, you know, you have to have every battle, you know, at this particular rating so that it uses a... And there's formulas for this where it's like it uses a particular amount of the resources, hit points, healing potions, whatever, that the players have. That's a video game thing that's really crept into D&D and it's really, to me, not what I enjoy. I enjoy the idea of a person sometimes being outwitted, sometimes just getting their ass kicked, sometimes dying, sometimes figuring out a way past the most evil bad guy by a surprise. And I feel that the more we get into the minimaxing, the less chance of somebody thinking outside the box or thinking inside the narrative box of their character and paying attention because they're paying attention to the mechanics and the minutiae too much. And their belief is their interactivity with the world is only these skills or perks or flaws that they may have. And, you know, some games give you cards that's like, here's a skill you can use once. And it's like, narratively, is that even described? I mean, you don't have to, but I'm saying for me, I want to narratively understand why this person has the ability to only have one ricochet shot per game. Right? Instead, why don't you just make the ricochet shot something that's incredibly difficult, but can handle or can happen randomly? Meaning sometimes it'll happen, sometimes it won't. Or use it as a rage slash willpower slash humanity, one of the hundreds of different burnable skills out there, and add a burnable skill into your game so that a person has to do things narratively, thematically to immerse themselves in the world to get those skills back so that they can do those awesome things, including training, by the way. I've seen a lot of people, including myself, who have the burnable stat be, you know, adjusted up or down via training, you know, training to do ricochet shots, those kind of things. So looking at this minimaxing stuff, I just want to bring one thing up and say, you know, There's a lot of different ways you can create a character, but I think Plants type is one of the more enjoyable ones to me. And what do I mean by that? That means I actually will keep a bad roll almost all the time whenever I make a character. So what does that mean? Well, my favorite character was a thief who could not steal at all. Sasheen Sarenlord. This is a character who was so terrible at stealing, he basically could not. But what he did was, and what I had for him was, very high backgrounds and resources. So this character, as I created him, turned into an absolute mythological grifter. What he did was, he had so much money that sometimes when people were hiring him to do jobs, he was paying off the person he was supposed to steal to buy the item that the people who had asked him to steal things wanted. And then he would pay people to tell stories about him. He would pay bards to sing songs about him. And he was terrible. He couldn't steal anything, but his charisma was really high. He was a grifter of unimaginable power and ability, but he just chose that he wanted to be that thief. He was the guy that maybe had some skills, tried a couple times, it didn't work out, and he found out somehow that lying was a little bit better. Almost like you'll see a character who maybe is a thief, but they're not great, so they start beating people up, and they stop using as many of the thief skills. It's just narratively a different way. And Sasheen, I remember naming him. I was in my office. I was working with another coworker, and we were making characters, and we just made this guy. And he turned into a legend, man. He was, I mean, like other characters in other games have like mentioned him or seen him. And everybody who hears about him, basically what I stated was that, you know, there's always this undercurrent of belief that probably he wasn't pulling off some stuff. But because he is so well known and so well resourced, you can never tell. And so other characters would meet him, those kind of things. You don't have to make somebody that good, but you can have a barbarian that's smart, you know, and you can have a mage that's stupid. You can have, a cyber runner that's not great at cyber running. What does he do? You don't always have to reroll those things. It's another reason why I use the idioms, because if there's a reroll ability in a D&D game or a role-playing game, when somebody's like, hey, man, you know, I want to reroll this, I'm actually like, okay, but let's make the character, right? Let's go with it. Let's make the character. Let's look at all the stuff, because those attributes probably don't have an effect on, let's say, how many skills he gets. If they do, then we can look at it at that point. But then you can sort of look back and go, you know, can I work around this? To me, those low stats, those low scores are the defining factor, not the strengths. There's so many characters in Dungeons & Dragons where you hear about them being super strong. Think about it. I mean, just think about that for a second. It's almost never the person who's not strong that you hear about. It's everybody's telling you about their strongest barbarian, Gronk, you know, or whatever his name is. But you rarely hear somebody be like, dude, my barbarian was like level 9, fucking had a, you know, 6 strength, had to hollow out the edge of his sword so he could swing it, whatever. You know, there's something out there. So I would just say, think about those things. And work them in. And for example, in one of our games, you have flaws and merits, and what those do, Werewolf does this as well. But you have flaws and merits, and flaws basically give you points to use in skills, but they offer a negative on you in some way. And it has to be fairly sizable, where merits are bought normally. But for example, you might have something like resources, and you might have 1 point in it. And that could be a very low level dude who's available all the time, or a fairly high level guy or a mid level guy who's available just once a month, right, to help you out in something, or has a very niche job. And as you add more points to that, you can just do it linearly, where it's just like, if I got a 3, that means 3 low level guys that are available all the time, or 1 even higher level guy that's only available a couple times a month. You get my drift. So I made him and got to those parts, and I was like, listen, man, you know, I've purposely not chosen a ton of skills other than social skills. And I put as many points as I can put into in a starting character. So a lot of games have a starting character limit for how many points you can put in any particular skill. So what I did, man, was like, this was a bunch of skill points. I was like, I'm going to merit this bitch out. I'm going to max out the resources as high as I can. I'm going to max out the contacts, max out the knowledges. And instead of picking a number or what have you, we're going to role play that these guys are just ironclad on my side so they don't leak my story. So instead of choosing one really high level guy for a 5 in resources, I chose one guy who is middle level, but who absolutely feels I saved his life in some way. Who absolutely, and what I started doing was I was like, you know, who are these people? You know, are they family friends? Are they this kind of stuff? And I really found out that my guy was sort of had a heart of gold, but he was just a dork. And so he helped a lot of people. And those people were like, we definitely won't tell anybody. And in fact, since you're not thieving all the time and going in and stabbing people, he did try to go on some of, you know, actual adventures and had varying levels of success. But I was like, you know, some of these guys, maybe they don't want everybody to be stabbed so you can get the opal of all time fire. And so they were like, hey, man, we aren't going to tell anybody your story. In fact, we'll have more people come to you because it just means less people dying and, you know, transactions of funds or something stolen is all that really comes out of it. I guess I would just say when it comes to minimaxing, when it comes to putting all this together, remember that everybody's a bit different, and a low score in something or a character that doesn't fit doesn't necessarily have to be thrown away instantly. And I think that people can get caught up in that because a lot of people come from video games. And that's fine, by the way, if you want to do that. I'm just saying that that is not a hard, fast rule. And sometimes a DM would love that and people just won't mention it. I've been a DM. I've been at events, which I'm not a huge fan of because a lot of those are a little too structured, but I've been at events where DMs are there and it's like everybody's all excited about their super high scores and they're all trying to figure out how to, you know, take a low score and go to a high. And that makes sense because it might be a one-off game. One-offs might be slightly different. They might be. But some of those DMs might have been like, holy shit, you want to keep your 13? You know, you want to keep your 11? Yeah, let's work on that. Let's make something cool. Now, one-offs, real quick before I wrap this up. I said that it might be a one-off, so maybe that wouldn't happen. But I got to tell you, I've done so many one-offs with purposely a band of misfits that suck at everything. Ocean's 13, but without any skill. And those are some of the best games ever. Now, you do have to be slightly more experienced in how to play off the cuff, I think. But those guys, I'm telling you, and gals, everybody, they can be fantastic. Anyway, that'll be it for me. I want to keep these short, under an hour, and this one's encroaching that time limit. I just want to say once again, ACGD in D&D, which is the hashtag. I appreciate all you guys showing up. Please spread the word. Please leave comments on any of the podcasting places you have the ability to leave comments. It really does help. I hope you guys enjoy these. I don't know if you do. But if you do enjoy them, I'm glad. If you don't, hey, such is life. Peace out, everybody. Check out the Patreon.